After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Welcome back to The Greenhouse, dear listener. I'm joined by very special guests. Please welcome Shay and Lennox of the Cool Zone Pod.
Hey.
Howdy. Glad to be here.
So, this is my second time having a external podcasters as guests, and my anxiety has suddenly kicked back in.
Yeah, it does. But actually, I'm anxious for Shay right now because they can't see it at home, but Shay's sitting in the exact chair that Matt Chrisman sat in when he came. You can tell because it stinks of weed.
Thank you, Lennox.
But yeah, thanks again for coming through, guys. Honestly, I know that the last time we talked when you had me on, we were able to kind of dive into the individual condition we're all in, right? And we talked about, you know, this historical moment of being an American empire. And that's such a useful framework for us on the left that oftentimes gets, you know, people will bat an eyelash at that or will at least, like, look at it with a little suspicion. But I find it a very effective framework, especially, you know, with 4th of July coming up, and we celebrate this great country and give, you know, our tributes to the Constitution and what have you, and Eagles and the red, white, and blue. I can't really find much to be proud of lately. And I think when you put some of the weird things about this country into that framework of understanding it as an empire, suddenly things seem to add up. When was the first time you got exposed to that framework? Because for me, it was like Kush Vlog, although I had kind of heard from, like, you know, third worldist types online, but I never really got into it until I got deeper into the left. You know what I mean?
I guess for me, it'd be like Chapo or TrueAnon. Mm-hmm. Although I feel like even before then, there's a certain, like, liberal kind of effort on, like, Instagram and other social media where they'll, like, give you little, like, brief histories of, like, shitty things that America's done as an empire. Uh-huh. But the difficult thing with that is that it's not really in a helpful framework to, like, understand conditions or the way that things affect people. It just, it, you know, what it pushes for, the viewpoint, I guess, is really that just, like, America's a shitty country. And I think that that's true, and I think that's good for people to think about. But I think that, like, there's a specific framework, kind of like what you were saying, of like, material-based analysis and how America kind of works its political economy, that needs to be applied whenever we think of America as an empire. Because, you know, in there lies the solution to how we end up, I guess, taking down that apparatus. There's a lot of slippery room in there to kind of take it down idealist notions where, like, if we just fixed foreign policy, if we just weren't as interventionist, then things would be a lot better. And that's not really where, like, the secret lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that from another perspective, I guess, you know, one thing that we look at a lot is, like, red diaper babies, like people that were kind of raised on the left. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't quite me. I was raised, like, very progressive, but it was always like, it was always kind of in a very combative sense. You know, it was like we have to simultaneously really dislike the direction that America has gone in and, like, very much its foundations. But where now I point to class as, like, this ultimate consistent issue. I was raised that it was like, well, the issue is race. Where race comes from, it's kind of just a nonsense thing. It doesn't really exist, but it definitely does exist to them simultaneously. If that makes sense. So I guess for me, my introduction was, like, very young and very, like, consistently a perspective that, like, to be black was to be really, really at odds with oneself as American.
Mm-hmm. I think those are those are two more unique perspectives than we get, because I think it was an idea that's always been out there in some context. Like, I was trying to look at the history of this framework, and I came at it as this, like, well, it's only us on the left who really seem to apply this. But even in the more neoconservative brain trusts, right, you had guys like Karl Rove insisting that America can act like an empire. There's in verbatim. You even have criticism of Roosevelt going as far back as like the Progressive Era, where they were talking about the actions in Cuba like it was imperialism. So it's like it goes as far back probably as the founding of the country, right? And I'm not sure to what extent you can draw a straight line of history from early critique of America as an empire to today. But it seems to me, at least, that like this is something baked into the American project as a consequence of it being a former British colony.
Yeah. And there's a really interesting way that, like, I guess the media apparatus kind of orients itself to that imperialism, because as you know, America has reached different crisis points throughout its history. You know, the ideology apparatus kind of starts to collapse around those times of crisis. And what you find is that there's a lot less fervent justification for these imperialist conflicts. You know, like the yellow journalism doesn't work as well. There's a lot less support for just those expenditures. And I think it's interesting to kind of track that pattern really recently, because, you know, you come to the end of pre-neoliberal capitalism in the 70s. Of course, there was a crisis for you know, a couple decades around that time. But as that gets resolved, you know, America gets its fresh coat of paint, I guess, nowadays. And when, you know, when neoliberalism from America really started to break down, you know, the sort of barriers of capital and reach its tendrils to form a new sort of globalist empire, I guess, like built on free trade or whatever. The ideology surrounding that, at least home, was pretty interesting in the sense that, like, people bought like the old timey notion of, you know, intervention for a really long time. Especially with the Cold War going on. I mean, there was like a global enemy. And I mean, this is something that a lot of people have said. But after, you know, that kind of big bad collapsed, America really didn't have a purpose to orient itself. And I think it was able to keep going because things were good. And, you know, this ideological framework of pro-intervention was able to last for a while. But now you see we start to come towards the end of the neoliberal era, and you can see, you know, different inflection points where crises are probably about to start. And I think we're at such an interesting part in the American empire because, one, people, if there was interventionist conflict, I don't think that we're in a moment where people would necessarily report that in the same way as they have in the past, when things were smooth during the neoliberal era. But two, I think that America as an empire really is reaching its final decline phase. And I wonder if America, well, I guess I don't think America can come out of this crisis. And I don't think that the capital is there to really try to contain this specific imperialist, you know, globalist project at this crisis point. And I think that, I guess it's important to conceptualize the way that this empire works, because once it breaks apart, it'd be good to have a heads up, I guess, of what that might look like. And I don't know how, I guess like factual you want to go. We could go like to how specifically like the empire works, how specifically America does imperialism. If you want to do that conversation.
Get into it. Yeah. Because like I'm really just trying to, I guess, evangelize the framework. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So whatever testimony you want to give the congregation today, we're willing to receive it.
Okay. I guess we can kind of start at the beginning of the neoliberal era, and hopefully Linux will drop back in the middle of this. Oh, okay.
I'm here. Yeah, I guess
okay.
From a fiscal perspective, which is perhaps the most important perspective to understanding, like, I guess America's intentions or America's actions overall, and certainly within isolated incidents. From a fiscal perspective, neoliberalism takes the shape of, you know, we think of it as a very controlled economy. We think of it as an economy that is consistently growing, that is managing inflation, and especially managing deflation in a very careful way. And we think of it as not hands-off, not free market at all, but also consistently not Keynesian. In an argument, now let me say it this way. This would be very controversial to a lot of modern neoliberal economists, but from a certain perspective, it's not at all that they have smoothed out the market and its natural fluctuations under capital, so much as they have created so many constant conflicts within the market as to make a bumpy line appear straight.
That makes sense.
And this plays out in, like, you know, your normal trading days of bull markets where, you know, you're buying because the price is only going up, and bear markets where you're selling because the price will only go down from here, and so on and so forth. But it plays out especially well when we consider that neoliberalism is based out of sitting in a consumptive position. This is essentially an empire built on debt, and its actual best way to profit is through collateralization and debt. Now, I could explain collateralization if you'd like. It depends on how much econ you like.
You know, I could use an infusion right now.
Okay. So let's say you own a home. Okay. So you can collect debt up to a certain percentage over the value of that home based on, you know, your perceived reliability of paying it back. So we will say, you know, you can finance against your home as collateral up to 1.5 times its value. Okay. So you want to, let's say you own a $150,000 home, you can get $225K in value out of it. And your home becomes collateral. Your home is functionally held in a trust by the bank pursuant to you paying it back, and you're just allowed to live in it for the time being, essentially. So that is a classic move. What neoliberalism said is that the bank can take that debt and can sell it to someone else for a profit for the bank. In doing so, the bank creates liquid funds, that is to say, it creates cash that it can hand out to people who come to the bank and say, I want my money out of the bank. And also in doing so, the bank can create a large profit for itself and its shareholders, shareholders typically being people who have put up a certain amount of liquid capital to the bank in technically giving the bank more liquid capital to buy or finance more collateralized objects. So let's say the bank originally only had $1 million, but so that would mean it could only do the same deal that it just did with you like four times. But it got investors, and now it can do that maybe eight times or 12 times. Now, the next step of that, and I guess where I would say we can see a clear end in sight to the market, is what happened in 2008, which is that we then triple or more so collateralize on that same object. Because what can happen is the object that represents your home, that is to say, the piece of paper that the bank has that says that they own it and that they've given you this amount of money in exchange for it that you will pay back, and so on and so forth. That can be traded as many times as anyone wants to trade it. And you can quickly run into a situation where a firm buys these And that is all that that firm does. It's not a bank. It's not insured in the same way. And then that thing, that entity, can go out of business because it has bought so many of these, and people have for whatever reason, be that a hiccup in the market or so on and so forth, stopped paying them back. And that was kind of your 2008 crisis. But if you look now, you will see a very similar trend emerging ever since that market burp, quote unquote, in 2018, toward Q4 2018, I want to say. Mm-hmm. One second, I'll pull it up. But my point is that all of this collateralization has come to pass from a few key sectors of the market. One of them is what we call the pound dollar exchange, which is based out of the city of London. And that really exists because they have archaic financial laws that really don't, they matter, but they are prohibitively difficult to explain without drawing a weird chart thing.
I mean, yeah, they're basically holdovers from the mercantile era. You know what I mean?
Yeah. They literally are, because the city of London is still in mercantilism. It's run by essentially, it's run by corporations that just vote on a board of options for the city, yeah. And people cannot enter the city of London. City of London. Now, okay, so here's what they can do that's special that the U.S. can't do, and what that means for the U.S. Okay. So the city of London can do a leverage move based on collateral, where they can say that we have this collateral and we will create wealth against the value of the collateral plus of your repayment plus of the interest all at once. And then we will hand off the collateral to the same to ourselves as a gift and eliminate the need for the collateral against the cash that we have just created and now have on hand. That they don't have to worry at all about whether or not you could repay. They are operating on the assumption that you will and can liquidate assets as soon as they own them.
And thus having it so heavily based on debt without considering the fact of whether or not anyone could pay it. And then, okay, there's the subprime mortgage crisis in a nutshell. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never fully understood what went down. Like, I understood that it was fuckery, but like, I've never heard it explained in such simple terms before. So shout out to you for that.
And now I will say, like, for example, the 2008 crisis, a Marxian economist would say that that crisis and the recession that it created did not end until like 2016 or 2018, mm-hmm. which also implies that the recession that we are currently entering came like 2 years after that.
Yeah, I mean, it was starting in 2018 is the sense I got.
There was weird
warnings around the corner that like, hey guys, be careful. The recession's coming, recession's coming. And then like the pandemic hit. So then it just came of its own accord. But the economic conditions of the pandemic are being viewed separately for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Well, that's really a language strange thing. And you can see, here's one example of where the Fed is slipping. The Fed being the Federal Reserve, right? Mm-hmm. So throughout the recession, firms needed liquid cash on hand to protect their assets from the debt-based collateralization that made up their valuations for their stocks. So what that means is, for example, let's just say Ford. Let's say Ford bet that they would produce 250,000 cars in the year 2020, and they gambled against, let's say, 40 factories that they would create from 40 factories and the assets within them already without having to buy anything new, 250,000 cars. Mm-hmm. So when they failed to do that, they now owe in stock, because what happens is to control Ford, the board of Ford has to buy stock a kind of a proportional rate to the amount of stock that is actually going on to the public market. Now firms don't like to admit that, and someone a bit smarter than me on this would kind of have a slightly different explanation. But so as Ford is not selling enough cars, they still have to pay debts on that, and they have to pay a normal operating fees. So to survive that incident where they have already collateralized themselves, the firm needed liquid funds on hand. And the Fed stepped in a role that normally a smaller bank would step into and said that we will constantly loan you money so that you can continue to employ people. Now, all that inflation is, like, that's what we're seeing right now, right? That's our price crisis at the moment. And it should catch up to menu issues soon. Menu issues being, like, the point at which prices have changed so much that you have to, like, reprint your menus. Mm-hmm. And menu costs actually a big deal in econ for some reason. But anyway, and that's what caused all this inflation, is because inflation has nothing to do with how much money is on the market, actually. It only has to do with how much money is perceived by firms. And traditionally, as in 2008, the Fed was able to control inflation by simply not informing firms of how much money they were printing and giving out. Which is kind of where, say, your MMT, your modern monetary theory people get in. Like, that's one of their key ends. It's like, well, we could just print enough money for everyone to be rich and just never tell the firms. Whether or not that is the case, I would strongly disagree with them. Mm-hmm. But it is certainly so. Basically, so the inflation crisis that we're currently seeing would lead one to believe that the Fed has done something dreadfully wrong, right? And, you know, there's a weird process by which the Fed makes money, but for all intents and purposes, they can just infinitely produce capital. And so I guess from a fiscal perspective, what's happened is outside countries now claim enough U.S. dollars and wealth to collateralize that against the U.S. And so the Fed has lost control over the dollar valuation, or is losing control over the dollar valuation, which means over time, as other states grow their dollar reserves, they will hold a larger and larger slice of a shrinking dollar pie, and can eventually sort of force the U.S. into a different sort of consumptive role.
I see.
For its own products, yeah. So that's, and that is kind of the end of empire.
And that's ultimately what Matt Crisman's getting at with making the United States the reserve world currency and making us the consumer at the end of the pipeline.
Yeah, and this is also something... Oh, sorry.
You're good.
I was going to say, this is also something like Lenin predicts, right? He's like, well, we're in an imperialist age and something like this will kind of occur. He doesn't necessarily use macroeconomic terms like that, but definitely that Mao predicts. And that's kind of another odd intersection is that Dungis would say, you know,
by Dungis, China can... Genghis, right?
Yes. Okay, okay. Deng Xiaoping is technically how you pronounce his name.
Gotcha.
But no one knows that. It's like Hoxha. Like, everyone says Hoxha. I don't really blame him. He spelled it silly. I don't know why he spelled it that way. That's a joke. But so a Dungus would say, you know, Mao said that the age of empire would end by like 2050, because Mao said, well, we have like 100 years from like 1950, 1960. And then there will be no more stuff for the empires to grow out and take. Ergo, the age of empire has to end then. And that's where the like China will become socialist in 2050 thing comes from, because their argument for socialism with Chinese characteristics is that when there is no imperial power to compete with, everyone will realize the mass efficiency of socialism with Chinese characteristics and adopt it for themselves.
And they don't fall into the same trap that the Soviet Union fell in of trying to compete with the West on the West terms.
Yeah, that's their perspective, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when you were explaining how neoliberalism works, right? I was recalling something that Yanis Varoufakis, when he was trying to explain how neoliberalism works, he kind of used a little bit more of a dramatic expression for it, where the banker, in his example, is basically reaching into the future to create extra value in the present. And it made sense, but I didn't realize that the mechanism quite literally works like that. And it's one of those things where, like, I, for whatever reason, didn't engage economics as much as I should have. And I'm kind of learning more about it in my later non-school years, especially, you know, trying to develop my more historical and materialist analysis. But this innate sense I've had for a while now of, like, there's no new money to be made now adding up because the new money to be made has already been pulled from the future in this case.
Yeah.
Fuck, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, the futures market is really fucked up. I'm sorry to use that term. The futures market is in a very dangerous position.
You guys can cuss. It's just...
Okay. And that's part of empire. And empire being, you know, the last stage of capital.
I mean, like literally capital has run up in a contradiction against time itself. You know, like it's good. I don't know where it's going.
Yeah, it's like living on borrowed time. Like, it's yeah, at the literally. Point now where we're not at the point of theory. It's now just spelling itself out in more basic terms.
Yeah. And I think that there's a really interesting way that you can, like, see capital progress in this way, slowly, like, speeding up and breaking down the different boundaries to let itself expand. I mean, you know, it's pretty obvious when you think about it, but, like, you know, America's empire used to be a lot more hands-on. Mm-hmm. You know, there were regime changes and there were civil wars and there was physical, like presence in these countries where America was attempting to extract wealth from. But after the war, and specifically after, like, the Soviet Union started to enter its decline, it's just, you know, imperialism has been able to be almost manpower free, you know, just with the sway of the currency and the relationship that colonies have, that these new colonies, I guess, have found themselves in against America. You know, they're still colonies in this way, and that their economy, their entire political economic organization is tied to its relationship with America, in the sense that, like, this is where, if not the production is being done, this is where the raw materials for the production is being done to send to America for the people there to enjoy. Mm-hmm. And this is really the state that American empire is in, at the end of the conveyor belt, where its tendrils spread across the nation. Capital really has expanded from outside of one state to be an entire global system with entire, you know, states fitting into that at different places on a hierarchy, you know. And that's really what you track as American empire, is really just capital expanding and bending these separate states unto the will of America as the imperial core at the end of the treadmill. And there's an interesting thing that go ahead.
I was going to say, and, you know, critically, there's the status within capitalism, or one of the iron laws of capitalism, right, is that you need to have information. Information is essentially what capital is born out of, because valuations are based on futures. Futures are based on what you know will happen or can predict to happen reliably. And so what's happened is we're not only on borrowed time, we're on constantly changing predictions of borrowed time. And that would be why I would personally argue that the internet was the greatest. You know, a lot of people would say, oh, well, it changed. It messed up Marx's prediction. It messed up Lenin. It messed up Mao's. Where I would say, actually, if anything, the internet proved a lot of it, because as information exchange became quicker, firms became able to consume larger and larger pieces of the pie, of the ever-shrinking pie, at a much faster clip, which then necessarily endangered their whole project, which is presumably why we haven't gotten anything quite better yet. With the exception of, like, Bloomberg machines. And so now we're at a phase where we're almost back to the value of, like, a human computer. Because, of course, before we had all this stuff, they used to pay people like Shay to sit in a room all day, and they would just ask them questions, and they would read little books and stuff. And that was a human computer, and that would, like, that was kind of how they predicted a lot of stuff. I know that sounds really weird, but it's an odd quirk of history.
So it was just like a literal guy just doing math in a
room? Yeah. Did you ever read,
like, a bookkeeper?
No. Not even necessarily math. Just like logic or like trivia. Did anyone read Sherlock Holmes?
So no. this is what, like,
this is what Mycroft Holmes did for a living.
Mm.
He was a human computer for Her Majesty's government.
I see.
Or maybe it was His Majesty's government. I don't know. He was, for the UK, basically.
For the crown, basically.
Yeah. And so he would just consume massive amounts of information constantly. And then would be asked questions and could kind of answer them and kind of make predictive statements about the market. This is repeated in the books Dune, the navigators in that, their whole thing where they're like floating in psychotropic substances and constantly exposed to like a web of information that only they're aware of. It's both kind of an anti-Semitic trope and an example of human computing. But that's also why something like AI is so critical to the market at this stage.
Because we need the next thing. Like, a computer has only really replaced the human computer, but then if there's something that can replace both.
Yeah. Because as it is now, you still have to have a guy. You know, everyone still needs a guy to interface with at some phase. And it would be much more efficient if you had a predictive guy that was an AI.
Mm-hmm. Deal with with the IT department once and for all. I guess it's good that we took a quick departure from the idea of empire to really get into the nature of neoliberalism, because it's also one of those terms that everyone has a definition for that's partially correct, but doesn't necessarily illuminate the whole truth of how it works. And I guess if we can try to tie it back to the empire, with the rise of neoliberalism, how does the imperial character change? Because you mentioned earlier that the physical hands-on management of empire, let's say with departments like the CIA, tends to slow down, and now we can just handle it through finance capital, right? Was that the only change, or was there more that happened?
I mean, from a political perspective, there were a few other slight quirks. You know, we kind of brought our military might inward. We changed up the military so that it wasn't based on a draft, but rather on a voluntary basis that was predicated on poverty and advance in society via the military, which is a much older concept than a draft, maybe, but is also very critical to understanding, I guess, how we have positioned the status of being in the army. And the U.S. has done a lot of myth-making. I wouldn't say anything currently ongoing within the U.S. empire is all that new. You know, there's very little new beneath the sun. But I would say that it's a lot of quirky modifications on the very old.
I think there's also like an interesting discussion to be had on how like class organization changed in these new like colonial countries. Last time we did an episode together, we talked a little bit about how like the political economy of America itself has drastically changed. Well, when this globalist, you know, neoliberal order was created, they had to change around, you know, the relations of production in these colonies too. And I was reading about this in a book I just finished, and it's interesting to tie it back with Mao, because when Mao was doing revolution in China, he had this concept of new democracy that said basically, unlike in the European countries where the bourgeois was able to take over the old feudalist government, in a colonialist country like China, the bourgeoisie is not strong enough to do a revolution. But neither is just, you know, the peasants or the few proletarians. So they had to use the productive forces of the national bourgeoisie to do that first bourgeois democratic revolution, which then would be transformed into a dictatorship of the proletariat. And the author of this book I was reading had an interesting point that said, well, neoliberalism has really destroyed the character of the national bourgeoisie. And it's something that at least I didn't think about for a while, but like the ways in which the relations of production in these countries really have changed, in the sense that, like, you know, before, states were pretty self-contained entities. Like they created their own industry. You know, they had more of a self-reliant economy. But as America, as this imperialist core, has emerged and made these former, you know, colonies into quote-unquote states, the industry within that country, that state for itself, has withered away because it's not profitable to the global capitalist machine. And so you find that there are no factories there to produce goods for the people in that country to consume, which, you know, was also the case when it was a hands-on colony. But you see that now that, again, that external physical presence has been withdrawn and now remains just this coercive economic tie that really has, you know, directed the flows of these countries back into the United States. And so because of this, we've seen the withering away of any sort of class that a self-contained political economy would have. And now, you know, the market really spans globally and doesn't have a lot of room for these more local, you know, individual country-based economies. And I think that impacts the people in an interesting way. Because it creates an interesting class character that I don't know if I could define definitely. But I think that it makes organizing a little more difficult, to say the least, when your boss has moved from, you know, somebody who lives in your town to some faceless blob across the ocean. And you know, the most you could do, I guess, would be to seize the state and once again maybe try to develop socialism in that country and create a more insular political economy. But because the country has even kind of regressed from the feudalist notion of, you know, even though there wasn't a lot of productive forces in feudalism, it was still a self-contained political economy. And even though we have things like factories, these factories are, you know, built to produce things like phones, toys and cheap clothes, and so there's going to have to be like a repurposing of these productive forces into ones that can sustain an insular political economy. And I think it just creates an interesting class consciousness in there. I think that there's still definitely revolutionary potential there. I mean, there are like 150,000 workers on strike in Iran right now, oil workers. Mm-hmm. But I think that maybe that there's a silver lining there. Where because capital is so global in nature, it has people looking outward to more of a world socialist project. Yeah. That makes sense.
Oh, it makes a ton of sense, because as you were bringing that up, I was actually thinking about that recent wave of farmer strikes in India, particularly. And when you said like the faceless blob, for whatever reason, I think in my read of how it went down and from some of the interviews I read with people who were at those strikes, the real basis of what some of these protesters, their grievance with it, was that a faceless entity is coming to decide farm prices at this point. And we don't need to engage in that just coercive model. And that was the basis for that movement there. And to some extent, you can even say that India's class formations are still somewhat feudal in some cases, right? But even at that level, it's bound to come into conflict with existing social orders. And hopefully those are the intersections at which resistance to the all-encompassing nature of neoliberalism can be stopped.
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear like Chrisman talk about it too, when he says that like the brakes have been taken off the machine, right? In the sense that like, well, there's nobody that you can really point at and say is directing this thing anymore or keeping it driving. And I think that really that is the nature of neoliberalism and its empire is removing the agency of the bourgeoisie in the entire capitalist order. And instead replacing it with its own logic. And of course, capital has always been this way. But when it was a smaller entity, you know, the individual capitalist owners had a lot more control. And also the working class did in these environments. And so obviously it was easier to organize, but also it was easier to just have agency over when you could take out a few key targets and kind of crumble the infant capitalism. But now again, it's the faceless blob, and it's that... You know, this class really just kind of exists as a formality in the sense that they don't run anything. And this was something that Linux, I remember you talked to me about a few episodes ago that we did, was that, like, again, no one's driving this anymore. And the nature of the bourgeois as a class has really changed in this way. And
I should amend that.
Almost an artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Okay? I mean, I should amend that and say that, you know, there is no more bourgeoisie in the sense of the national bourgeoisie that Mao was able to work alongside, right? Or if there is, those people's class position is so radical in its spot that they are as much pets of the international bourgeoisie, like you say, like your cabal or whatnot, as anyone else. And that's kind of where so much conspiracy thought goes wrong, right? Like, at a basic level, if we're going to say that capital is knowledge or capital is intelligence of what will happen in the future, then it makes necessary sense that the highest managers of capital must preen themselves based on how much knowledge they can accumulate of the future, which also implies that there has to be a very high level manager of capital, or it kind of would have disintegrated in the modern information age. And so pursuant to that, we have to understand that, you know, when I'm saying like the lunatics are running the asylum, I guess what I mean is that the bare witnesses to wealth are not in power. It is someone a bit shadier, and someone perhaps a much larger club than we would think is exercising a greater power over everything.
So that kind of
it's interesting.
Paints the question I was going to ask was, you know, if the wheels have fallen off the system, like Shay was saying, and even like Matt Chrisman says that to some degree, right? It kind of begs the question, so then what's Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos's role in all of this? And it's highly likely in this case that maybe someone like the supercomputer never disappears. They just occupy a different role in that elite sphere, you know what I mean? And if you're talking about like a shady super manager of capital who's really just watching the machine go buck wild, we don't know what he thinks of it or what he's deciding to do with it. Is this where, I guess, in your estimation, who makes up that kind of person? Because, you know, the strict answer a lot of us are thinking of right now is like, oh my gosh, it's Epstein. But it could be someone a lot more banal. You know what I mean?
I mean,
go ahead, Shay. Go ahead, Shay.
I'll go first because I kind of break with the idea that there's like, that there is like a manager on top. Because like within the core that we have in America, you think like somebody like Epstein, you know, the people that are the wealthiest in this country didn't really get rich the way that people used to, in the sense that they were just kind of witnesses to wealth, and that they just happened to insert their cart right in front of the flow that capital was already heading towards, and that anybody else could have stepped in for their role, and the same thing would have happened. Like that was just the logic of the system, and there had to be a man at the top. And I don't really think that's how people used to operate. I think that's why those sort of like work ethic, you know, ideology still kind of lingers, because back when capital was closer to feudalism, there was a little bit more personal agency, even in the capitalist class, of how to direct their own business, and. So if America really is at the top of the capitalist order still now, I don't think there's anybody running it. And that's why I think that the system will come to collapse necessarily. Now, when we look to China, though, you know, there's not as much a case of people inserting themselves in front of flows and getting successful. There's a little bit more agency in the capitalist class and a bit more agency in the state itself, right? I mean, the most obvious answer to who is running this thing is the state, but we know that that's not true in America because it can't do shit even for itself. Mm-hmm. And it's powerless to affect really the speed and the direction that the system is moving at all. In China, on the other hand, where we have a bit of a foundation of planning and government participation in the economy, you know, we can look to there and say, well, there's a bit more direction. But as for America, you know, really breaking down these barriers, the breaking down of these barriers that neoliberalism did kind of took all of the agency out of it for profit extraction. But of course, this contradiction comes to a head soon. And so I think maybe after, you know, the collapse of the neoliberal system and whatever comes after that, we might see another class of people who are actually capable of driving the system and of capital itself. But my take is that at this moment, capital is being governed by its own logic.
And that comes from a fundamental split where one of us kind of pursues a more cybernetics influence per, line of thought. And I, of course, come from a very like... I mean, I come from a skeptic's seat, and I guess that for me, I'm kind of the Du Bois to Shay's Garvey on this one, where I say, well, that assumes that nationhood matters to profit. That assumes that that nationhood is still relevant broadly, or that it's drawn out of something other than, you know, the best bards and poets of the 19th century going into states and drawing, you know, out of a mass of people a collected identity that just didn't exist before and was not necessary before, and has you know, created the worst atrocities of our early age. Not that I'm against nationhood, but that I don't see a reason for the market to care, so I can't bother with
it. I mean, I guess to that I would say that, like, when nationhood was created, it was created in conjunction with the state, which was a material necessity in order for capital to operate itself. So nationhood is definitely tied to the logic of capital because it was there when it was formed, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I thought you were the Luxembourgist. That's a joke because Rosa Luxemburg rejects the identity or authority of the nation, and Lenin builds on it. I, of course, am much more Leninist than I am a Luxembourg.
I mean, I'm not saying that like national identity is something to be rejected, but it's just like it's something that can be utilized in other ways, like Lenin used it. I think that necessarily it isn't something that's like that. Is devoid of meaning within capitalism itself. Like, capital has a use for nationality that maybe the workers could co-opt for their own.
At the very least, the market can at least commodify it, you know?
I mean, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's we took several interesting turns with this discussion. And I'm still happy with how it turned out. Because to really understand Empire, you can't divorce how an empire functions from the real system on how it generates its wealth, right? Like, when this is where, you know, understanding the historical empires, we're understanding systems like the Silk Road matter so much, right? So this may have to be part of a bigger series, and I'm okay with it turning into that. And we can maybe just focus on neoliberalism and how this market seems to function a little more. And I guess, I don't know, is it, for the purposes of the day-to-day subject, does it really matter for their need to act whether or not they know if there's someone on top or not? Is this just some kind of autopilot program gone wrong, or if there's someone at the helm of this, does it really matter to the person on the ground?
I mean, you know, maybe not to the person on the ground, but if we take, you know, the Leninist line, then somebody's got to be the leader, and I think that there should at least be a good, and of course, you know, relying on the mass line and like encouraging the participation of somebody on the ground to theorize and to participate in that struggle of figuring that out. But I think that somebody should have at least a certain conceptual notion, whether or not I'm right, or it comes to be found later that there is somebody in charge, and then that's what, you know, you go after. But I think that for the, if there is going to be a revolutionary movement, then there are certain things that probably can only be figured out in practice, kind of like I said last time, but that do need to be figured out in practice in order for the revolution to succeed and the experiment afterwards to bear fruit.
And I guess just to not end in a weird argument, it's also possible that in creating a sort of self-governing system for itself and gaining, you know, something that a nerd would call sentience, capital has just created a native or nascent class of self-managers. It's created a class of nurses for itself. Mm-hmm. And that an example of that would be like your intelligence agencies.
Yeah.
Like who deal in literally intellect, because of course there's difference in the value of states and in their intelligence capabilities. The U.S. Has a massive intelligence state, but it's bleeding heart. It's incredibly inefficient because all that we know how to do is bring in and process data in ever growing servers that consume more and more electricity and water every day. And the way that we collect that data is through back doors that we've conveniently left in every corner of our webs, of our internet, which is the majority of the world's internet, which then means that because we've left so many back doors, so many little operatives everywhere, that it's in the best interest of other countries like Russia or China, so on and so forth. It's in their best interest to just find those exploits and use them. So, you know, it's a constant Tom and Jerry cat and mouse game, where, you know, on the one hand, there's so much information you could never ever possibly get through all of it, and you would just have to randomly fish indefinitely. But on the other hand, one has to wonder what we're even paying all of these people for, what we're paying the intelligence agencies for, and why they're constantly growing if they cannot even protect themselves.
So I had a bit of a thought, sure. And you guys can push back on this, is that at this point, trying to think of it as like a sentient but inanimate object, maybe one way to look at this, is it also just worth considering the neoliberal project, how it functions on autopilot to some extent, and the quote-unquote army of nerds that heeds its beck and call, is it more useful to just look at it as a giant cargo cult?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the argument that I got at in one of our latest episodes, which was that, you know, at a certain point, the economists are interpreting data that is given to them by studying consumers, who are studying advertising, who are studying economists. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very self-fulfilling cycle that is highly inefficient and bleeds bleeds value everywhere, which is expressed in waste. And on that certain line of thinking, it is a cargo cult, but there are managers of that cycle because, of course, we know from the laws of thermodynamics that a system acting only upon itself experiences such entropy that it falls. Mm-hmm. So there's something other than just new stuff from the dirt coming into the system, and that would point to a certain management, if that makes any sense at all.
It makes sense. This is just big brain time. You know what I mean? Yeah, the greenhouse is a bit more of a it's a bit more of a chill space, but I'm glad that we were able to get into this, because I don't engage theory as much as I should. I think I just have so much more reading to do, right? But the complexity itself of neoliberalism, the people who defend its complexity to some extent, as well as all of us trying to unpack it, and even how tedious that task becomes, right? Does that have something to do with why so many people fall into the trap of defending it? Is they just see this big complex thing and assume, well, it's got to be working end to end somehow? Or is that just wishful thinking on the part of the people loyal to it?
I mean, I guess I take kind of the Zizek approach here, which is that, like, this global system was kind of formed without our agency. Mm-hmm. And there are certain suspensions of, like, ideology that we have to make in order to operate in it. And, you know, when you're active in it, it's easy to be swaying towards its at least baseline arguments. And I think that, you know, there's a certain sociological reason for the people that we see that, like, really defend it. But I think, like, on the whole, like, why are so many people still caught up in its own logic when it's so obvious that there's this faceless blob and this sort of irrefutable evidence that it's heading towards collapse? Is that, like, there's not really been another alternative proposed, I guess, in the sense of capitalist realism, but more than that, is that, like, you're not engaged in any project to overcome that collapse or to negate that collapse or to imagine something beyond that collapse, and you're just participating in it without actively fighting against it and learning from that. It's just so easy to be absorbed in its own logic.
And from a more, I guess, classic Marxist perspective, we existing in the material conditions that produced capitalism and continue to reproduce capitalism have a reality shaped by its existence and presence in our lives,
exactly,
which warps how we could ever possibly perceive anything else. Which is where you get that fun little silly little quote, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, because your entire reality has been fundamentally shaped by it and has fundamentally necessitated it for so long as you have been conscious. And so I would say that the reason I know that empire has to end rather quite soon is because there will run out of things there will run out of pieces of pie, which would indicate that you gotta change, because the clock done run out.
Yeah.
In the basketball game. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it kind of feels like it's not that the clock is going to run out. It's, at least how I'm looking at it lately, is the clock ran out a while ago and we're still just sitting in the gymnasium trying to pretend this game is still going on.
And that's also possible.
considering economy and considering, you know, the material base, it's really important to understand how empire functions, even if you're not necessarily getting into the actual concrete examples of that functioning. It's important to, and again, like, this kind of hits on what I brought up at the beginning of the episode, which was that if you don't have a foundational understanding of the mechanisms of the empire, the way that you consider the actions of the empire can get skewed. So when you have this conceptual understanding, this foundational political economic conception of, you know, the way that the empire considers class and the way that it has hold over different, you know, groups of people, then you can sort of look at the actions of the empire and what the CIA does and what the FBI does and what the military does and fit it into a sort of historiography and a sort of logic function of, like, this makes sense because it fits into this parameter that we've already defined the empire to function as.
Mm-hmm. The type of discussion we had surrounding neoliberalism, for a lot of people who at a very core theoretical level and just with going off of what they've learned through osmosis, understand why it's bad, but, like, couldn't explain the picture to you from point A to point B. You know what I mean?
That's something that, like, Marxism as a whole has been incredibly useful to me. It's something I still think about almost every day, is that, like, I mean, for, you know, I was raised pretty liberal and I was pretty politically minded from an early age, in the sense that, like, I was able to recognize that there were things around me that weren't functioning properly, and you're able to see that, like, these are bad things happening, this is a bad policy, this was a bad move, this is bad for this person, but you don't really have the framework to fit the solution into, you know, and you don't really have the framework to apply the same mechanism to all these happenings. Everything feels just really entropic and random, and there feels like no concrete solution to really solve the overarching problem. But once you have, you know, Marxist political economy and things like class come in, you're able to start fitting these things into a framework. And I think that's something that, like, I'm still learning about all the time, is just the way that, like, the system itself functions. But if it helps you understand what's going on around you, and it helps you understand the current reality you live in to better combat it and to better, you know, influence those around you, and just to maybe be at a little more peace at the end of the day, you know, if anything, it helps me at least to at least have some semblance of knowledge about why things are the way they are.
So we had a pretty extensive discussion at this point. It took several turns, but there was a lot to be gleaned here. And I think there's a future series that can be derived from this. So is there any, I guess, way to maybe wrap up what you guys have got here, or just something you want to close on before we switch to plugs?
Well, you know, I would neither despair nor necessarily rejoice, because as we learned in the theses on Feuerbach, which feature one of the best pieces of Marxist lit, which you can Google and you can find for yourself. Mm-hmm. Marx kind of gives us the idea that we shouldn't spend too much time trying to predict future material, because we're not in it, and it's going to be so alien as to be otherworldly, and would essentially break our minds to try to imagine beforehand.
And yeah, I mean, really, the discussion on empire, better understand how the world operates, isn't a prediction to the future. You know, it's just a way to better understand the reality that's going on around you, because we're participants in the empire. We have our role in it, and in the mechanism. To be able to understand your role in that, how it relates to the rest of the world, you got to study the political economy, which I guess is what I've been saying for a while. But
yeah.
I think it's worth thinking about. Folks, if you like the conceptual stuff, come on over to Cool Zone. We do a lot of history, we do a lot of culture, we do a lot of philosophy. It's fun. Anything to add, Lenny?
That was really it. It's been a pleasure to be on here. This is really fun. Thank you for kind of letting us deep dive like this.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, it was my pleasure. One of the things I really love about Cool Zone is just how willing you guys are to just get really deep in the reeds with it and it's accessible enough to the point where even a dummy like me can still keep up at least two thirds of the way. And, you know, via osmosis, you pick up a lot about some of the deeper philosophy and theory that you sometimes just don't have access to or may find a little intimidating at times. So,
yeah, I mean, you can't read everything.
Of course. No. You should try.
You know, there's a lot.
You should try, though.
You should try, too. But, you know, books, you know, oppose book worship, like Mao says, like, the answers to everything aren't going to be found in a book. There's a lot to be found just talking with people and going out in the world and hearing different people's perspectives and sort of dialectically coming to a new synthesis between three different, you know, material backgrounds. No matter how well-read you are, you know.
All right.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks again for coming to the Greenhouse.
Happy Diskin.
Yeah. Yeah,
had a great time.
So, final plugs for us. The show is Greenhouse Gaslighting. You can follow us on Twitter at @podgreenhouse or look us up on Facebook, Twitch, Instagram, Grindr, Bumble, I don't fucking know.
Also, our Twitter handle is @CoolZonePod.
Yeah, yeah. Give them a follow. Be very nice to them. They've been so supportive and have really been good friends to me in this crazy industry we call podcasting. And as a show of, you know, appreciation from all of us at the Greenhouse, seriously, just go to Apple Podcast for whatever fucking reason. If you give someone 5 stars, it helps them with their show. Just do it. Do it.
Oh, that would be great. That would be so nice. Oh, I love reviews. Now I got to go leave you a review.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
We're doing quid pro quo here.
Quid pro quo.
All right. Well, thanks again for tuning in, dear listener. We'll see you again at the Greenhouse soon enough.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on?